Jonathan Coleman is the co-founder and director of the Faulkner Morgan Archive. His book, Anywhere Together, A Queer History of Kentucky, is forthcoming from the University Press of Kentucky. He is also somebody that I had the wonderful opportunity to work with on a register of the Kentucky Historical Society special issue, Beyond the War on Poverty, Appalachia Post-1970. Jonathan's work is the first LGBTQ article in the issue, which I'm really, really excited about. And that issue was something that was put together thinking about Appalachia in the late 20th and into the 21st century. So we were looking for thoughtful perspectives on the current state of Appalachia and eastern Kentucky. We wanted to ignite new conversations on regional identity, race, economic structures, and political issues. Certainly, as always, and I feel like we do this a lot as Appalachian historians, dispel common misconceptions and chart a way forward into the 21st century. I did not know anything about Lige Clark, who was from Hindmond, so it was something that I very much enjoyed learning about my area. He grew up not too far from where you and I, actually, in far eastern Kentucky. So how did you learn about his story, and what did his early years growing up in Hindmond and Appalachia, how did they shape his future?
Well, thank you, Stephanie, and your response that you didn't know anything about Lige is really common. You have to go to New York or to Washington to find people who know the story of Lige Clark. He's not so well remembered in Knott County, but in these big, huge LGBTQ hubs, you know, he enjoyed a bit of mini fame. And I found out about Lige from another Kentuckian who had went in the great gay diaspora to New York. And his name was Dick Leisch. And Dick Leisch was president of the New York Mattachine Society, organized what is arguably the first formal civil rights act of LGBTQ Americans, Julius the Cyprian. And we were good buddies. Dick has sadly passed since our first conversations. And one of the first people he told me about was Lige, you know, his fellow Kentuckian. They wrote together, they did activism together. And as I was part of a study for the National Park Service on LGBTQ history in Kentucky, Lige came up again. And through this, I was able to meet his sister, to meet his nephew. And here became an important story that I didn't realize I already knew all along. One of the first things that Dick showed me was a copy of Welcome to Fire Island, a very famous early gay book. And on the cover is a singular figure, and it's Lige Clark standing there in the sand, his arms open. He's a beautiful man welcoming you to that famous gay New York playground. But his start was in Knott County. So here we have this important early advocate for LGBTQ rights who is also centering his Appalachianness, his hillbilliness in that activism.
And you mentioned his work in particularly the LGBTQ movement in New York. He was editing and writing for various publications. How do you think he used that background to frame his own arguments and his own writing for gay liberation?
So what makes Lige Clark so interesting is the fact that in many ways he embodies this perception of what it was to be gay in the United States in the late 60s and the 70s. Sexually liberated, happy, healthy, coming out, you know, this post-Stonewall generation that are starting to cluster in these big cities like New York, like San Francisco, like Washington, like Miami, and based upon a gay essentialism, right? That I am inherently gay, and that this is a central part of my identity. And so Clark, in many ways, is the poster child for that on the surface. But in actuality, he is bucking against all of those trends. For the most part, he centers his hillbilliness in his arguments in a sort of, you know, if you know the term strategic essentialism, he takes these two intersecting identities of being queer and being Appalachian, and he uses them to be within both groups, allows him a certain sort of power. And he tells stories about his own youth growing up in Hindman and what he saw as almost a sexual ideal, that people were sort of left to be free to a certain point until they got so old. He said, then the Methodists and the Baptists won't let you have fun forever, I believe is what he wrote, in which sexuality was really fluid, generally tolerated. And he believed that this was the natural human form of sexuality, and that it wasn't until you get into these repressed urban spaces, the cities, where people are forced into channels. And so his idea of a sexual liberation wasn't one based on, a gay-straight dichotomy. He believed all human beings were sexual in their own way, and he wanted a sexual fluidity like the one he experienced growing up in Appalachia. Now, this is, of course, not how LGBTQ, the history of sort of the theory behind sexual practice has been written. And Lige's dependence on fluidity, right, and a more kind of natural sexuality that's beyond definition is decades ahead of its time when it comes to other LGBTQ activists.
And it's interesting how he, as you mentioned, how he used his background to frame his own narrative. I think there are oftentimes LGBTQ voices, Black, Indigenous, Jewish, Asian, what have you, in the mountains that are minimized or at times completely omitted from the larger historical narrative. Talk a little bit about what you think Clark's story tells us about the LGBTQ community in Appalachia and why it is so important to amplify these voices.
Lige's story tells us, I think, going back to that point on intersectionality, it amplifies voices in two places. You know, the wonderful scholar Mary Gray once wrote that queer Appalachians are always out of place, right? Queers aren't supposed to be in Appalachia. Appalachians aren't supposed to be in queer spaces, right? But here you have Lige, who is beautifully occupying both identities. And so you have someone who's taking what in many ways is considered, like in the national imagination, a nadir for queer people, right? Appalachia. It's an inherently hostile environment. And here, very early on in the movement, someone who is at all the major events, Stonewall, you know, the first gay pride parades, all this sort of stuff. And he is centering his gay activism on his hillbilliness. So here you have someone who so strongly identifies as a rural, queer Appalachian person, right, who's in these big urban places talking about his Appalachianness and what can be gleaned from that. So that is something, as an Appalachian person, that's a legacy that you get to have as part of your legacy, too. And so it changes, right, how queer people get to exist in Appalachia, but it also changes how Appalachians get to exist in queer spaces, right? That the story is much more complicated, that it's much more complex. You know, Lige never represented Hyman as sort of a mountain ideal. You know, he had lots of complicated feelings when it came to his hometown, but still, he saw it as a place of possibility, that there were values that could be translated into, you know, Greenwich Village in New York. So amplifying these voices, not only Appalachian voices in queer spaces, but queer voices in Appalachia.
In doing research for this article, you had mentioned interviewing Lige's sister and some of his other family following his untimely death in 1975. What was something that surprised you most about his story? He was a very interesting, very outgoing. He was, I mean, in so many different places. What was the one thing that surprised you the most?
Oh, it's hard to narrow it down. I'd have to say two. One is the fact that the gay rights movement was so small when it came to certain people. I mean, it seems like it's the same 30 people over and over again. And Lige happens to position himself in the places that matter at the time. So almost all of the big early gay activism events, Lige is there. You know, he is one of the first people to ever write about the Stonewall riots. He is one of the first people to interview Bette Midler. As I mentioned earlier, he hand lettered the signs that are at the first LGBTQ picket in front of the White House. So That's amazing, just how many fingers he had in so many pies. And the other thing is the lingering impact of his work. So his sister, Shelby, and his nephew, Eric, especially. Eric himself is gay, moved to New York. He's an artist, and he tested positive in the late 1980s. And Shelby, really coming off of her brother's own activism, becomes such a major support, not only for Eric, but for the broader AIDS activist movement, you know, writing letters to her elected representatives, to the president, and supporting Eric and his community. And Eric survived. Eric is a well-noted artist in New York circles, and Eric's work often reflects back on his uncle's activism too. So even though Lige, you know, was killed so early on, and he missed so much, you know, and he's been gone over 40 years now, his legacy of activism is still very much alive and still important.
One of the final things that I wanted to touch on before we wrap up is your book that you have with under contract with the University Press of Kentucky. So Anywhere Together, A Queer History of Kentucky. So talk a little bit about that and your work as the co-founder and director of the Faulkner Morgan Archive.
The book came out of the work with the Faulkner Morgan Archive. We began collecting stories of LGBTQ Kentuckians. And so the book will look at the breadth of Kentucky history, starting all the way really with the first European settlement to the present day. And we followed this continuous thread throughout the Commonwealth of people who today might identify as LGBTQ, people who were queer for their own time, who are staking their own claims in Kentucky and who are making an impact, who are carving out just the space for themselves in this state. So you have Kentuckians who are making an impact outside of Kentucky, like Lige, like Dick Leisch, but also Kentuckians who are performing activism within Kentucky. For example, a group like the Gay Liberation Front, which was at the University of Kentucky, and who in 1970 will sue the university in order to be officially recognized. So we're working really, really hard in terms of getting these Kentucky queer stories out there for folks to use and utilize.
I'm very much looking forward to being able to read the book and seeing the history that you're going to be putting out in the future. And it's been wonderful to work with you on the Register article. So thank you so much, Jonathan. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Stephanie. This has been a real joy.